The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we will be talking to Matt Norman-Cameron as part of our mini-series on green jobs. Today's episode is hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare. Mahnoor Kamran is a 19-year-old Pakistani-born student and climate justice advocate working within policy. Mahnoor is on the Good Energy's Good Future Board to advise and challenge the renewable energy supplier on their initiatives, business policies and ethics. In 2023, she will work alongside the think tank Sustainability First and energy regulator Ofgem on their youth forum. Mahnoor grew up between South Asia, one of the most climate vulnerable regions, and the Middle East, a net exporter of oil and gas. Upon moving to the UK, her understanding of marginalisation and inequality enforced on societies most disadvantaged solidified when she witnessed that the people of the global majority were one of the most affected by the climate crisis. Mahnoor has advised businesses, industry leaders, the Department for Education and leading environmental charities on how to tackle the underrepresentation of people of colour in the sector and embed climate justice and intersectionality into their work. Previously, she has mentored young people her own age on environmental projects and was also a judge on UNESCO's Young Environmentalist Award.
Mahnoor, welcome to the podcast. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. It's honestly such a pleasure to finally meet you.
So I wonder if you could start by perhaps introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about you and the work that you've been doing as a youth climate activist and youth consultant.
Yeah, so I just turned 19 literally a few days ago, but I've been in the climate movement, I would say, since 2020. So this is like lockdown time. Like that's when I started really getting ingrained in the movement. So I grew up, I was born in Pakistan. I lived there for 5 years. Then I moved to Abu Dhabi, which is a city in the UAE. Then I moved to Oman, which is another country in the Middle East. So I essentially grew up in the Middle East. That's where I had all my experiences. That's everything that I learned was in the Middle East. And then I moved to the UK around 5 years ago. So I've lived in essentially a lot of different countries with different economic sectors, countries with different poverty levels, different industries. As you see, Pakistan, Karachi, for example, one of the largest slums in the world, whereas the UAE and Oman are petro states. You come to the UK, which had the British Empire and all the climate catastrophe that they caused. So I started seeing these issues in isolation at first. I started seeing the destruction of the people in Pakistan and the heat waves and the flooding. Then I saw the oil spills in Oman, and I saw like how access to nature in the UK is limited to people of color. And in 2020, when I had the time to really like think about these things, I started looking at the things that caused all these issues and how interdependent these issues were. And that's when I knew I wanted to do something about them. I mean, I've always wanted to do something about these issues, like ever since like primary school, whenever we had like science competitions, I would just choose a very geography focused one, whether that be like urban river flooding or eco house. And although that is still science, it's still very much like environmental stuff. So I wasn't really putting a conscious like decision into that. That was just something that I was interested in. And that's when in 2020, I started putting all these experiences together and I started reading so much about the news. And with Black Lives Matter, there was so much about how race intersects with climate and class. And then in 2020, I applied to this youth environmental program for young people called Bright Green Future. And that's essentially how I got into the climate space, because they essentially train young people, have mentoring schemes, local projects. You meet people on the program that have done different types of environmental work, people that have just started, people that are protesting, people that are working with businesses, whatever. And so I started really getting ingrained with BGF, and that's how I started. And within that, my local project was about climate change and how it impacts people of color, both in the global south and in the global north. And so that's when I started really getting into the system thinking, the causes of the climate crisis. And then from there, I would talk to people about it, but then certain industries and businesses and NGOs were in contact with BGF and they're like, we want to explore more about this. And they were like, yeah, Mahnoor, she's been doing a lot on this topic. maybe you could, you know, talk to her. And that's when I really started getting involved. And that was basically my step from the climate movement, as in like the youth climate movement, to like the professional sector. And it wasn't something that I was, it wasn't something that was intentional. It wasn't something that I was expecting. I just joined the climate movement because I just wanted to, you know, make a difference within the youth climate space. But then suddenly I was like put into the professional climate network at the age of 16. And so I was essentially the youngest person, probably the only teenager in like many of these conferences, many of these spaces. And so that's when my youth advocacy, climate justice advocacy, all of that started. And then I started applying to different things. So I became a youth board member at Gooden Energy, which is the UK's like first 100% renewable energy company. And that was because I was very interested in like the just transition, global inequality part of the climate sector, not necessarily, I'm a nerd about like, you know, wind turbines. It wasn't that. It was more about the justice side to it. And from there, I started speaking to the business about it, did consultancy with them. And then earlier this year, I started doing consultancy with Ofgem, which is the energy regulator in the UK, again, about justice and energy and the energy crisis and how people are being affected by it. And again, I was the youngest person there, but again, this was a youth board, so it did feel more inclusive. So yeah, essentially my work is around energy justice, climate justice, and I do youth consultancy with businesses, NGOs, environmental NGOs, social justice NGOs, around climate justice, around intersectionality, around youth inclusion, around EDI and why we need all these things. I speak at events. But yeah, in a nutshell, that's the type of work that I do.
Amazing. And you've been doing all that alongside full-time study as well, which is a fantastic achievement and something that you must have had a real challenge juggling this lifestyle balance and all this important passion-driven work, but also the academic side of work behind it as well. So I wonder if you can perhaps share with us as a young person how you found your voice and your ideas has been valued or been received perhaps by the older generations that you've been working with.
I mean, I'm going to give you the real answer because I don't want to like sugarcoat anything. And I think that's what's needed because like I was given like a sugarcoated version. I think being the only person there, but then again, I'm a woman of color. I'm a Muslim. I'm a hijabi. I'm a visible minority. I wasn't ready for this shift because I grew up in the Middle East, very diverse place. I went to international schools. So the people I was around were people from like 80 different countries. When I went to the climate sector, I was maybe the only young person there and maybe the only person of color there, period. Like that was it. And what was also apparent was the very like rigid, like neoliberal thinking of the people at the top and trying to dismantle that or oppose that as a young person with like no sort of no sort of support system within those spaces was very hard. Like I was saying stuff, but there was no like reciprocation. Instead, I was like sort of being marginalized. And I think that really took like a toll because I was like, what's the point of doing all this work if like nobody's willing to change? And I think that also took a toll on my mental state because I was in these spaces with no support systems, talking about very important stuff, talking about the abolishment of this capitalist colonial construct or talking about this and talking about that. And I was talking to some very, very powerful people like CEOs of like top businesses in the world. And I had nobody that I could go to say, hey, this is what's happened because I was the only person of color, the only person with a different opinion in that space. So it's been hard to navigate, but I think I've sort of found like an adrenaline rush from it now because I'm like, this is what's needed. It's never happened. This is what's needed. And the more I did it, the more I got used to it and the more people I found. And now that I go to these places, I can find my community. We make a group chat where they're like, okay, this is what we're going to say. If anybody needs anything, we're here. And I think it's just so fulfilling that you've got other people with the same views as you in these spaces that are willing to challenge it. And then what's even better is the reward that comes out of it when there has been a change that has been made because of what you've said. But yeah. There's both sides for this. People that are very nice, but then there's people that still are very stuck in those like very rigid ways of thinking, I would say.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I suppose as a trailblazer, I suppose in some fields, then you're almost always going to be one of the first, one of the minorities in this area. So you mentioned that support system that initially you felt you were lacking, which it now seems like you might have seemed to have found and perhaps started to set up for others. So I wonder if you could tell us about that as a sort of young person, how you can start building that support system, that network of people to help support you on these you know, challenging fields. As you mentioned, you're talking to some serious people with a lot of investment, with a lot of political interests, with a lot of economic interests that, you know, are older, more experienced, and are perhaps thinking, you know, why am I listening to this, to these kids? Well, you know, why have we brought them on board? So how can these young people get that support?
You see, that is the exact same question I used to ask myself, and I was just hitting a dead end. And that's when I realized I wasn't in the spaces that I wanted to be in. I think if you're craving that social connection and craving that support, I think reevaluate where you are. And that's not saying don't stay in those spaces. That's saying branch up, open up, go to these different spaces. So I was within the climate, I was within the energy justice space. And then I went again into organizing and more of the climate justice community-based activism. And that's where I really met the people that shared my political views. And although I didn't stay with that organization for long, I was there for enough time to meet people. And then I got their Instagram, I got their social media, and I was like, hey, let's talk about this. And they started opening up to me about their problems when it came to the environmental sector. And then I opened, and we all made a group chat, and we would all be there like, okay, we're going to this event. If anybody needs anything, does anybody need to stay over? I can provide food. I think if you're craving that connection, branch up and really look at the different organizations that are open to people, because I kid you not, you will find your people. I think for the first year that I was in the climate advocacy space, it was also COVID. So meeting new people was completely, it was an alien idea for a lot of us. And so I think that was where my loneliness stood, because I wasn't able to physically meet people. Or even if I was, you know, you don't have that same connection on social media. Whereas as soon as, you know, lockdown finished, and I was able to go out and meet other people in different conferences or organizing events, canvassing events, that's when I really started feeling that human connection. And that's when I really started building my support system. But also, I think it takes time. I think I was like really punishing myself at first. So I'm like, I feel so, I don't know why I'm doing this. Maybe I should quit this. I need a support system. Everybody has a support system. But I think now the more time you give yourself and the more time you spend trying to make these connections, the better you'll get at the end, and the better friends you'll make in the end.
Yeah, that's fantastic and really important advice. Thank you. And do you have a particular mentor? Is there an adult in your life, either through your studies or through home life, or through the sort of energy sector or the groups that you've been involved with, that you sort of reach out to, that acts as a mentor for you still as a young person that's on this journey?
So when I was part of Bright Green Future, one of the things that they do is mentor young people. So I was essentially being mentored through my local project, and that was great because I was really uncertain. This was the first time I'd done this. It was during COVID. I was like, I don't know what I can do. Everything's closed. And so they really helped me navigate that. But then with Bright Green Future, I actually went back as a mentor. So I was basically mentoring people my age about the same things that my mentor mentored me about. So essentially, I was doing their job, but they were also there, so they could still mentor me. And I was still talking to them about, you know, this happened to me. How do I navigate this? Could you help me with this? So I think I can always reach out to people like that, because you make those connections and people love talking. People love giving advice. I think sometimes people get, like young people, essentially, they get really paranoid about whether or not they're going to get an answer from this person. I think, you know what, send your email, send your LinkedIn message. If they don't send it back, if they don't reply, that's fine. But there'll be more people that reply to you than you think. And when you go to these events and you say these different viewpoints, you'll know that there are people in the audience that agree with you that might not necessarily have maybe the confidence or the privilege to speak up what you're saying, and they'll come to you at the end, they'll talk to you about it, and those people turned out to be some very powerful people as well. So again, just speaking up and sending that LinkedIn message, sending that email, like if you want to email me, you want to LinkedIn message me, sure, I will help you out. I think a lot of people are willing to help out. Yeah.
So it's just about being brave and taking that first step and reaching out.
Absolutely. And you can make mistakes. Like I remember I sent a message once and it was like really bad grammar. I forgot to put like capital letters, and the person was so nice about it. And then I realized, you know, everybody's human. Like if they want to mentor you, they're probably a nice person and they're human. They understand you're a young person. And it's also like not the end of the world if they don't reply to you.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable advice as well. It's okay to make mistakes, but at least reaching out, then you're making mistakes in the right direction. It's better to try and make mistakes than not try at all, right?
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
So during all the amazing things you've been doing in terms of your studies, the youth board membership that you've been part of, the advisory board, you must have learned and developed quite a lot of skills that you think would be useful to other young people that are interested to sort of pursue these kind of activities as well. So what would you say have been the key skills that you've learned or that other young people might benefit from?
I think when it comes to skills, especially at this age, I think time management is like the first skill. And I think I'm still, to be honest, I'm not saying that I'm like a time management master. Like, to an extent, I am also a procrastinator. I'm just like you guys. I think time management is so key, especially because a lot of the things that we're doing right now as young people, GCSEs, A-levels, universities, these are like one-time shots, right? Like, you have to do them now. I'm not saying that, you know, obviously there's circumstances and all that, but you have to do them now. And so you have to sort of put your mind to it, right? You have to put your time towards that. But at the same time, if you want to do this climate work on the side, you need to manage your time really efficiently. Sometimes, you know, if there was a free period in school, I had to choose between whether I should have done that maths past paper or replied to this email. And you have to look at what's what and what your priorities are. I know you emailed me like before exam season and I was like, hey, I have to cut off right now. And like, knowing your boundaries and knowing that, okay, like, this is a time I actually have to cut off because I need to focus on this particular A-level or this particular GCSE right now, because you know that you have your life in front of you, so you can do this work all the time. But I think finding the time management balance is like key. But also when it comes to skills, I would say being confrontational, not in like a bad sense, but in a like passionate sense, and really standing your ground. I think the policy spaces that I've been in, I've all like worked with the Department for Education, right? And they obviously, you know, they have very different views to a lot of what young people have. And you had to be very, like, you had to stand on your ground and be like, no, 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 this is what we want. I know this is what you want, but this is what we want. And because knowing, being in these spaces makes you realize that everybody has an agenda and everybody has something that they already pre-prepared. And they're there to change your viewpoint, to get them onto your side. And what you need to do is stand still, stand grounded, and challenge, and as well as take, essentially fight your own battle, because sometimes you're the only person there. So I would say like standing your ground, but I don't think that's something that's like, that should off put somebody, because I think everybody has that raging passion inside. Once you find that passion, whether that be for anything, you know, it could be for like a TV show, whatever, you put your life to defending that TV show, you know. So it's like, you need to find that burning fire and like keep it in and not blow up, essentially, but be very confrontational, because some of these experiences you're only going to have once in a lifetime. And some of these experiences and some of these positions that you're going to be in are very important and privileged positions. So using that and firing back is what I think, that's a very important skill, which actually I didn't know a lot about. But then as time went on, I learned how to debate. I learned how to negotiate. I learned how to stand my ground in places where power was like diffused into every aspect. But yeah, I would say that.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. And is that something that you think you found more challenging, perhaps being a female and a woman of colour and from the minorities that you mentioned earlier on? Do you think that's sort of an extra layer of added challenge to being a youth as well?
I think for me, I've always been very passionate about issues. So for me, the saying part wasn't the problem. It was the receiving that was the problem, because I was saying things. And obviously people were like, oh, she's just saying this because she's this and she's a Muslim and whatever. So I think the response to it was what shocked me. But saying it wasn't hard, because this is like my lived experience. For a lot of people, they weren't as passionate about these issues because they weren't living through them. And I was living through them. So the passion was there. I think with people of color, the passion is there. It's just the way that we are reciprocated and we are looked at. I've always been called, you know, she's resilient, or she's so powerful. And I'm like, okay, you can call me these things, but actually act on what you're talking about. Actually act on what you're saying. You can call me passionate and whatever, but there's no point of my passion if you're not going to change your ways. So yeah, I would say there's obviously the whole intersectionality thing does play in real life. But I think that's also just a part of the society that we live in. It's very unfortunate. Yeah.
Definitely. So you've mentioned a few challenges that you face. What sort of opportunities do you think as a young person in this field perhaps lay ahead of you? What would you expect to be going into in the future?
Ooh, okay. That's such a good question, because like my future prospects change like every 2 minutes. Like that's why I'm choosing geography as a degree, because it's like very holistic and I can choose whatever I want to. But when it comes to careers, so I started off with politics. Then I realized politics wasn't the only way to make a change. it was a whole thing. But I want to go into policy overall, and I think policy is great because it's so holistic. So right now I've been working on climate change policy, but that also intersects with education policy, that intersects with land rights, that intersects with local politics. So I think with the climate sector and the holistic nature of this crisis, I've been able to look at different policies and different issues from such a holistic lens, because I've been exposed to so many different people from so many different backgrounds and industries. And I think learning about that and also making those connections, I can like harness that in the future. And like whenever I want to, you know, pop in for an interview or whatever, and I can, you know, contact somebody else and be like, hey, I don't know too much about this. Do you mind telling me about your career? So I think that's really great, because I think as young people, we don't really have spaces where we can connect with individuals and connect with people in the industry. And I think being in these spaces, I've made those connections, and I give my friends those connections as well. My friends that are not in the sustainability industry, I help them as well. So I think it's great finding connections when it comes to like grants, for example, and I can send my friend an email saying, hey, this person's opened a grant for this project, you should apply for it. So I think, yeah, I think being the industry, especially the professional industry, and meeting all these different people will help me with like the policy stuff that I do in the future, should I pursue it and not change my mind in the meantime.
That's the challenge, right? It's interesting, the more people that I've spoken to in sort of the green jobs field, the more I've realized how people change, and they start out in one direction, and then they sort of come across sustainability somewhere along the way, like, oh, that looks interesting, let's go that way instead.
Exactly.
Many career changes, and the more you realize that sustainability is sort of holistic and integrated into everything, the more open it becomes and the more interesting it becomes to explore. So you've worked across governments, across industry, locally, internationally, nationally. Are there any sort of upcoming or current global developments or local developments that you really think are going to significantly affect the sort of future of young people within this field?
Ooh, okay. Well, I know that like nationally, I was working with the department again for education. They're trying to put a few projects out. Like I can't speak too much about them, but they're trying to put a few projects out related to sustainability in schools. But again, I think that's for like really young kids, like 7-year-olds perhaps. I think I'm a bit cynical about young people's space, like young people in my generation. So I'm talking about 19-year-olds within the sustainability industry, because I just don't think that there's been enough awareness about the jobs there. I think obviously me and you work in the spaces, so we know that sustainability is integrated into everything. It's every job. Green jobs are everywhere. We need green jobs. But I don't think that there is that knowledge about these green jobs. I was speaking to a few people from the environmental charity sector, and they were like, we went to these sustainable organizations and they don't need conservationists. They need financial people. They need the legal staff. And that's still a green job. But I think that hasn't transcended into like our youth rhetoric yet. So I don't know how optimistic I'm feeling about that, especially looking at like the diversity figures within the environmental sector. But I think AI, I was looking at a few of those metaverse things, because they've done a lot of work with like the UN climate space, which is still very controversial. And they were talking about how AI can influence policymaking, which is something I want to go into. So I'm like, take it out. Don't do that. Don't take my job. But it was talking about how AI can look at quantitative policy statistics and like analyze them. That's something that's not what I want to go to. So that's fine. But it was very interesting how a machine can essentially look at all this climate data and put out, you know, future predictions. So I think that's something that will become even more prominent as technology advances, as people search for more climate data, as climate change becomes more mainstream. But yeah, on a local level, I mean, I live in Stoke-on-Trent, and unfortunately, there aren't that many youth organizations here. I don't think there's any youth organization here, which is pretty depressing. I don't think anything on a local scale, but it would be great if there was something, some organization that could put pressure on the council or something. But unfortunately, not looking too optimistic about it right now.
Wow. Hopefully someone from the Stoke-on-Trent Council is listening and they can get that rectified. So it's interesting that you mentioned this sort of talk about climate education. So we ran a competition this year for our international essay competition. We asked young people how they could be better supported to thrive in green jobs. And the key messaging that I would say we got back from the sort of 1,200 students that's entered was they didn't know about green jobs really before they'd taken part in the competition and started doing research. They didn't learn about them in school, and they felt that there was a lot more that needed to be done to promote green jobs, and that sort of that breadth of green jobs, as you mentioned, green finance, green administration, or how a sort of non-traditional green job is still a green job, and how we can promote those to young people. So have you got any thoughts on how we might be able to better increase youth knowledge and awareness in this sector?
Well, I think this is a UK-based approach. Obviously, it's different depending on the countries that you're in. But in the UK, and I experienced this too, you have every year you meet somebody from the council that tells you about jobs. I don't know if this is like on a national scale or maybe this is just a city scale. And so they would like tell you to go into finance and tech and whatever. Like that was it. Like you, if it wasn't medicine, it was finance and tech. And I was like, that's not something that I'm interested in. I want to go into the environmental sector. And she actually laughed at me. She's like, what are you going to do with that? There's nothing there. And I'm like, no, there's so much there, blah, 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 blah. And I listed out all the things to her. So I think like making those connections at school, especially because when you go to university, you're already thinking about your career and you apply to university when you're in school. So embedding that into the school curriculum is so necessary. But I think on an international scale, obviously it's different based on each country's context. I would say, I think educators have to embed it into the curriculum. And I think there has been a shift, or even like, forget the jobs aspect to it. Educators need to embed climate education in first, period, because you need to do that in order to inspire people to pursue that as a career. So I would say it has to be education-led. And we've talked about this, everybody says this, but that is the answer, because a lot of young people find out about these careers through school. And I know a lot of people are making LinkedIns now, but I think that's just a minority few that are making LinkedIn profiles to look at careers. And I don't think that's the most helpful way for like a 14-year-old to navigate this, because I think LinkedIn is very controversial and it can make you feel like, it can make you feel bad sometimes. So I would say it has to be ingrained into the school curriculum for this transition to take place.
Definitely. I think that's really important. And TSL is doing a lot of work to hopefully help support teachers in that as well, because there's been a lot of discussion amongst teachers about not feeling supported or knowledgeable enough on how to deliver that. So hopefully that's something, as you mentioned, the DfE in the UK are working on. I know that other countries are working on that sort of climate education for both students and teachers as well, which is so vital. So I wonder, is there a sustainability hero that you have, someone that inspires you, either of a similar age or older, that perhaps has, you know, encouraged you, or you thought, wow, you know, that's someone that is really important in this field. I want to try and follow that path.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like I meet people every day and they do such amazing things. And I'm just so inspired by my friends and the work that they do and the effort that they put in. There's also, I don't know if you know Michaela Loach, based in the UK. So Michaela Loach, they're a Jamaican British activist, and they actually took the UK government to court over their net zero scandal. But Michaela does a lot of work about like around abolition of the systems, and she does a lot of systems thinking and how the climate crisis is integrated and is the cause of this crisis or poverty and class. And so she's very much on the abolition side about all these things. And she's just, I've been following her since the start of my journey. And I even reached out to her and she messaged me back with such a lovely message. And I said, Michaela, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have like the confidence to go into these spaces and cause an intervention. Because Michaela actually, they got a Bill Gates Award and they went in there and they challenged the space. They intervened, they took the stage and they challenged it. And I think that's what's so needed. We need people to be in these spaces and challenge them, not be in these spaces and act as a passive, you know, activist. We need people to challenge these spaces, because these spaces are very, again, rampant with power dynamics. And many of the people there are the cause of the climate crisis today. So I would say Michaela Loach, very big inspiration of mine. And then also Aisha Siddiqa. She's an indigenous Pakistani woman who currently, like myself, lives in the West. She lives in New York City and she does a lot of climate justice stuff, land rights. She goes again to these UN spaces. She intervenes, she mobilizes young people. And I think looking at people like that, people that share the same views as me, people that look like me, people who are living in the same countries as me but are also from a different country, I think I feel most seen through their activism, because it's the type of activism that's accessible to me. So I would say, again, Aisha Siddiqa, Michaela Lewis, but there's so many different types of people. Vanessa Nakate, Malala is also another one, even though it's like not climate change, it's still education, and that ties in. Yeah, so many, I couldn't name, but yeah, I follow a lot of people, seeing everybody's different view. Like a lot of my friends are like really, you know, big name climate activists. So it's just, it's amazing. And all of them are sort of interlinked as well. So they have a support network. So just like nice seeing everybody else. But yeah, that would be my answer for that question.
Great. And I'm sure that you yourself were probably an inspiration to a lot of young people as well. So I'm sure you don't put yourself in that category, but I'm putting it out there that I'm sure that you are, which is one of the reasons that I connected with you. So I wonder if, sort of reflecting on your own experiences, what you feel in terms of the value and input that you've had as a youth board member for some of the organisations that you've been part of, you know, what you feel that you've been able to get across to those organisations and how directly you've sort of been able to impact their policies, their development, you know, do you feel that you've had a real meaningful interaction, or do you feel that it's been sort of a tokenistic gesture in some ways? Because that's the challenge I think a lot of young people feel. You're just involved with me because you feel like you have to, but you're not actually listening. Or do you feel that actually the Good Energy Board and Bright Green Futures really are valuing young people's ideas and opinions?
So when it comes to the youth stuff that I do, so there's permanent stuff that I do with Good Energy and Bright Green Future. And then there's like freelance based stuff that I do with like different charities, businesses, NGOs. And so it's, again, it's different based on the type of industry you're talking about. I think with the NGOs, I think they're better when it comes to youth advocacy because they really want to ingrain it into their work. And I think a lot of the work that I do is already by young people that are running these NGOs. So I'm essentially working with people maybe 6-7 years above me, but they've had the same life experiences. They share the same, you know, sentiments. They share the need to pay your interns, to pay young people. So I really appreciate that. I think on the business side, when I've worked with different businesses and industries, there's actually been instances where I haven't even gotten paid for what I'd done because I had no idea that I could even get paid for it. I was 16 at the time and I started doing some of the stuff. And I remember some youth NGO was like, oh, we can pay you for your time. I thought that was a discovery. I thought that was completely insane. I was like, oh, you can get paid for doing this? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, but this business just asked me to do this and I didn't get paid for it. So I think it's like learning to stand your ground. I think now I'm grateful that I found my voice and found the confidence to say, you know what, hey, if you want this, please pay me. Or actually not pay, please pay me. Pay me because I am providing a service and other NGOs that don't even have the amount of money that you have are paying me and are paying me a fair living wage. So why aren't you paying me the same? And there's been a lot of interesting conversations, a lot of difficult conversations, but like, thank God, like, you know, something's come out and I've been able to fight for better pay for people. I've been able to fight for pay and that's made a difference. But yeah, I think youth washing is very prominent in the sector, especially like even at conferences where you're like the only young person there, the only hijabi there, you'll see that the camera is on you. And I've been in places, very high profile places, where I've come back home and, you know, there's been a picture of me, but nobody said my name. Nobody said what I said. And the irony was I was talking about youth washing and that organization youth washed me. So I was like, this is very ironic. But I think it's like also learning about what's right and what's wrong and calling what's wrong out when it needs to be. Because I mean, like the economy, like we can't be working for free sometimes. I mean, obviously I understand free labor, but if it's a business and it has money, it should be paying you. So I think that's also something that I've worked really tirelessly on, but it's not an easy fight, especially when a lot of the parties don't agree with you.
For sure. So how do you think as an organization, what perhaps would be your message to organizations, businesses that really do want to work with young people? How can they get young people involved in a meaningful way and so that those young people do feel valued and do feel like they're really contributing?
I think the first thing is to, and this is a view that I came across this year, and this is something that I've thought about recently. It's like, who are you selecting as your young person in the first place? Who are you selecting? Because I've been in these spaces and I've seen very privileged people being in these spaces because their parents found out about this application process or their parents helped them out with this application process. If you're a TNC that's working with different countries, and if you're just having a youth board based off British people, what message does that send? And what type of inclusivity are you actually practicing? You're not taking into consideration the people that are being impacted by your business decisions. So I think it's like with businesses, I think there's different levels to it, because there's some businesses that will just recruit like very privileged people, and those privileged people will have the exact same mindsets as the businesses. So are we actually seeing a change? They might be a young person, but are we actually seeing a change? I think there's so much nuance in the young person conversation, especially in a world that is like rampant again with power dynamics and intersectionality and positionality. But if you're a business, ideally, number one, you should be like, not even ideally, I mean, you should be paying. If you're a business, you have the money. If NGOs can pay me, a business can pay me. First thing first, you pay. Second thing, you respect young people's boundaries when it comes to the work. I had to juggle A-levels alongside, and that's not something that's easy, especially because I was in year 13. And there was instances where people would be emailing me and expecting me to reply. And I had to make it very clear that I'm in school. It's not even like I'm working. I'm actually in school. I can physically not access my emails. So I think when it comes to young people, you can get them to the table, but it's actually the inclusion process. That's the problem here. A lot of young people are like, they want to apply to these businesses. They want to be on these youth boards. I mean, for Good Energy, we had over 1,000 applications. So young people are there. They want to apply. It's the inclusion part of businesses where they're not really respecting the rights of the young people in terms of pay, in terms of respecting boundaries. But also it's sometimes like, oh, you'll meet this, you'll only stick with this department. You're not really going to branch out. And so that's a problem, because young people should be having a say at every stage, and limiting them to one department is sort of tokenistic. Are you actually making them sit down with the actual board of the business? Is that something that's happening? Because that's the exchange. If you know the board members are making decision, you need to have the young people there to speak to the board members, not to anybody else, but to board members, because those are the people that are going to be impacting the business decisions and the climate crisis and all that. But yeah, I think there's a lot of nuance that's needed in terms of the young people conversation, because I think I've been tired by people saying young people, young people, young people. But I'm like, okay, what type of young people? People with disabilities, people of color, Muslims, Jews. Like, we need, young people aren't just like one holistic, homogenous group. We have so many different experiences and so many different viewpoints. And sometimes I think people that are open or people that are very privileged get to sit on these spaces and call themselves like the young people representative, where it's like, are you actually my representative? Did you actually speak to me about this? Was there actually a vote on, oh, you're going to go into the in this space? There wasn't anything like that. So it's like, how can you call yourself our representative when you don't really share the views of like the majority of us? So I think there's a lot of nuance that's needed in the young people conversation. But I would say making young people go into the spaces where the decisions are being made is key to like the inclusion process, but also like respecting people's boundaries. I've been very fortunate in that a lot of the youth advocacy, youth NGO stuff that I've done has been with people that have just graduated from university. So when it came to A-levels, they were so supportive about me just logging off and taking a break, because they understood that this is such a valuable time for a young person, and this is such a needed time to study, whereas some other people might not understand how essential this study time is for me. But yeah, I would say that would be my answer.
That's great. And what value do you think that meaningful engagement brings to a business or to an organization with young people?
So I think with us, we are obviously more future-centric, because I think that's something we're going to be living through. But I think that's also a misconception. I think when I go to these businesses and somebody asks someone the question, it's always, oh, young people will think about the future. Whereas like, you know, the traditional people won't. And I think that's actually a very like privileged point to have, because I think with the climate crisis, it's not just something that's going to affect young people in the future. It's already affecting young people now. It might not affect British people the way it's affecting my friends and family back in Pakistan, but it is still affecting young people in Pakistan. So it's like, I think young people won't just have that future mindset, but will have that justice mindset. Because if you look at the climate justice movement, it's majority young people. And I think that's where the difference is. It's not just about the future thinking. It's also about the intersectional and holistic thinking that young people have had because of the climate justice roots. And I think the fact that these young people can go to these spaces and bring that justice element, bring that intersectional element. I think that's what's different about young people compared to the status quo.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And I just wonder, we're coming to the end of our time now, but is there any sort of key advice or key messages that as a young person you would give to other young people that are interested in sort of pursuing a sustainability or a green career or exploring the climate justice or climate advocacy space that you would want to pass on from the benefits of your experience?
Yeah, I would say, and I say this to everybody, I think there's always going to be like some sort of gray area where you're like, I'm not sure, should I take this opportunity, should I not take this opportunity? And I think that happens to everybody. That's happened to me as well. I've been uncertain about an opportunity that was presented to me. I accepted it, and guess what, I'm thriving in it. So I think accepting that, but also like trying to, what I did when I went to Bright Green Future was apply to as many things as I could, whether that be energy policy, food policy, water aid, whatever I could find, I applied for it. Even though a lot of those things weren't really like my niche, but I applied for it and I got so much out of it. I think apply to as many things as you can, even something that you think isn't of any interest to you, apply to it and find those connections. I think if I hadn't applied to these things, I wouldn't have been able to get the skills. I wouldn't have been able to meet different people, build the networks. I think apply to as many things as possible, even if the thing you think you're applying to is like really unreachable. I don't know, one of my friends applied to this really, really prestigious internship that's only given to like master students, but they were like an A-level graduate and they still applied and they knew they weren't going to get it, but they applied. Why? Because once you get rejected from it, you can ask the person, oh, why was my application rejected? What were my weaknesses? Then the recruiter emails you back, gives you all the answers to it. And you can use that to make a better application and, you know, work on your skills. So I would say apply to as many things as possible. And if it does seem like it's out of your comfort zone, that's honestly a good thing, because I think with school, we're like shielded so much. And the fact that you can apply to these different things and learn and get out of your comfort zone, it's like really needed. And I think you can really harness that when it comes to the environmental sector. So that's what I would say.
That's great. I love the idea of being brave, applying for everything, taking opportunities, even if they're outside of your comfort zone or sort of possibly areas of interest, as we mentioned earlier on. Sustainability is such a broad subject, exactly. And sometimes you don't realize that you can get into it in other ways. And also the idea that you mentioned of getting feedback. So has there ever been any feedback that you've received that, you know, has been really valuable to you that you haven't perhaps realized or thought about and then have been able to transform that into being a really positive sort of learning experience?
Okay, so I think feedback would generally, I mean, a lot of the things that I might not get the thing for would be because I don't have like a degree, for example, because I was just a student. But when it came to feedback, it was very interesting how the people that were successful were people that were in this specific climate space for like a very small time, but they were really able to talk about that specific experience extensively on their application. And that's something that I didn't do, because I didn't know that you had to talk about that. I thought it was more about putting all the experiences. But that's when I realized that if you focus on one thing that you've done that relates to the application you're sending off, if you focus on that one thing and really like tie it into the mission of the thing that you're applying to, that's a very valuable, what do you call it, career advice, application advice for anything. And I didn't know about that, but now I do know about that, that recruiters really want to see, or the climate space really wants to see what you did with that one specific, on that one specific project and how that really ties into your entire journey. So I would say that.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's really good advice too, being specific as much as you can, even if it's a small piece of experience.
Absolutely.
Or it's not perhaps most recent bit of experience, if it's relevant to what you're interested in, it's really great. Absolutely. To talk about and, you know, show that passion for the interest and the subject.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier on about sort of the online space. How has that changed in the time that you've been sort of in this field of climate advocacy and climate justice? Because obviously you mentioned COVID when everything went online, and then we're very much driven by social media and the sort of that side of things in terms of news and publicity and information sharing. So how has that space sort of affected or impacted you, do you think?
So again, I got into this because of the online space. I think with a lot of the climate justice stuff, a lot of the residentials, a lot of the programs, they're all very like London based. But like during the pandemic, a lot of them became online programs, right? And that was like the only way I could ever participate in these programs, because I couldn't just go to London like that during a school day. So I really appreciated the fact that during COVID, it became very accessible for a lot of people to join the climate sector. But I think in many ways, when it came to youth climate advocacy, a lot of it moved from like the Friday climate strikes to online activism. And I think that's great, but I think there's also like certain limits to it. I think there's a limit to how much you can share and how much of it causes an impact. Obviously, you can talk about advocacy in terms of awareness, but it's like we still need the change makers, we still need the climate strikers, we still need the policy people. And if everybody's going to go on posting about infographics, that doesn't really do much for the climate movement or the cause, because everybody's just posting the same things, but there's no action that's being made. So I think that was a very big concern with COVID and with a lot of the climate activists, was that a lot of people had just become, I mean, you've seen like eco-influencers, right? A lot of people had just become eco-influencers with like no structure in the back. They weren't really carrying out the same actions anymore. It was more like PR stunts, which a lot of people that are still fighting for land rights or fighting for other like more radical causes were very disappointed about, because they're doing all this stuff, but now everybody's moved to like, hey, look at this oat milk, you know, type of activism. But then I think now with lockdown easing, a lot of stuff has become in person. But I think what's really sad is a lot of the pre-pandemic stuff moved online, and it sort of like lost its roots. I know I've seen spaces where people would go, maybe people of color would go pre-pandemic, and they would talk about their climate justice advocacy and whatever they feel like. But now, because it moved online, you don't have those same personal connections. But I think, yeah, the climate space being online is still a very big benefit, because you can find out about so much online, you can reach out to people. So that's a great thing. But I also think there's a limit to how much social media can help with climate activism, especially if it becomes very passive and you're not actively engaging in the work that's needed.
So it's about having that education, having a space for those conversations, but then moving it forward and taking action is the vital step. Thank you ever so much for joining us today. Your time has been fantastic. It's been so interesting to speak to a young person that's just finished their studies, that's going to be going on to do amazing things, but has already been so active in this field and has been doing so much for youth advocacy, for climate justice, and for, you know, advising and sort of taking those trailblazing steps to get young people's voices authentically heard by big business, by industry, by government. And we're so excited to see what you go on to do in the future. We wish you all the best with your gap year and then your studies. And we very much hope that you'll keep in contact with TSL so we can support the work that you do, and that we can keep you in contact with our young people. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. And if anybody wants to reach out, I'm on LinkedIn, MahnoorKamran. I'm always there. You can just drop me a message and I can help you out.
Thank you. I'm sure that our listeners will appreciate that offer of sort of mentorship and advice from a young person that's trailblazing in the field. And thank you so much for your honesty as well. I know it's not always an opportunity to be honest about the challenges that you face, the difficulties, but that's so valuable to young people to have that honest opinion. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you for having me. I mean, it was great that, you know, I was able to speak freely. There wasn't like the set of agenda that I had to like tick off. So thank you so much for giving me this space.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Mahnoor Kamran. Episode hosted by Kirsty Shakespeare. Organised by Kirsty Shakespeare and James Myers. Music by Paul Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org and join our online education community.